Just a little bit left, and we'll have completed our subject matter for this weekend. We were hearing about Sudama's visit to Dwarka, Sudama, Krishna's dear friend. His reluctance to go, his decision to go, his thoughts while he was traveling to visit Krishna. Krishna's eagerness to see him from a distance. He saw him coming, approaching. And Krishna didn't wait. Krishna went forward to receive him like an honored guest and sat him on his own seat and worshipped him. Embraced him, puzzled the people who were looking at this beggar-looking fellow, and Krishna was embracing him like his brother, dear friend. Their exchanges about serving together in the ashram of Sandipani Muni. Just appreciating the different voices that Krishna was speaking from the voice of a Kshatriya honoring a Brahmana, from a voice of a dear friend honoring a dear friend, from a voice of the Supreme Lord. It's very clear from the Bhagavatam text that not only Sudama, but also his wife, they understood that he is the personality of Godhead, the soul of all souls, the spiritual master of everything, the husband of the goddess of fortune and everything. And yet there's this other dimension. He's your dear friend. So some important teachings about the spiritual master-disciple relationship are found in this chapter. Very wonderful. So that section ends after Krishna says to Sudama what is most dear to him, this submission to the spiritual master and rendering all types of service to the spiritual master without any personal consideration. He then narrates Sandipani Muni. They went to gather firewood for the yajna, and a storm came, and intense wind and rain, and the sun went down, and the rain didn't stop, so they took shelter in the forest. In the morning, Sandipani Muni brought all the boys from the school. Where did they go? Found them. The first words were his appreciation for the sacrifice they had made for him. Because that's what they were in his school. It was a sacrifice for their teacher, for the service to their teacher. And then the following verse is another very important guru-disciple relationship text. Again, there's lots of commentary on this from our acharyas, but specifically the this one sacrifices oneself and all of one's possessions. The Sanskrit is not exactly atma, but it means atma. And atma can mean body, mind, or soul. In this case, our acharyas say it means the body because most people identify the body to be the self. So you utilize that which is you and yours in service to the personality of Godhead. Sandipani Muni says this is the duty of a student. And you both have done that. You boys are first-class brahmanas. I'm satisfied with you. May all your desires be fulfilled. And may the Vedic mantras you have learned never lose their meaning for you in this world or the next. And what happens is we learn something, some time passes, and if we get that something, it leaves our consciousness. Now, that's in worldly things, that even with Vedic mantras, that is a risk. And so he's giving them this benediction, and he's giving the benediction because of their qualification of service and submission to Sandipani Muni. So Lord Krishna speaks after quoting what Sandipani Muni told them. We had many similar experiences while living in our spiritual master's home. Both of us can realize that without the blessings of the spiritual master, no one can be happy. By the mercy of the spiritual master and by his blessings, one can achieve peace and prosperity and be able to fulfill the mission of human life. And Sudama's understanding was, and not only that, but I was able to go through that experience with Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead. So, what good fortune. And any external hardship, inconsequential. Hardship may be inconsequential because of a strong yes over here, the other is insignificant. So then Sudama speaks, and he's addressing Krishna as the personality of Godhead very clearly. O Almighty Lord, your body comprises the absolute truth in the form of the Vedas, and thus the source of all auspicious goals of life. That you took up residence at the school of a spiritual master is simply one of your pastimes in which you play the role of a human being. So as it is said in the very beginning about the qualification of Sudama, this the beginning of the chapter where Shukadeva Goswami is narrating, he had two qualifications. Complete detachment from sense gratification and filled with knowledge. So now this little discussion we had, your question about disgust, it's commented on here. Next. So we're on another chapter now, chapter 81. And Sudama is holding this, embarrassed, he's holding this little handkerchief or cloth tied with four palmfuls of broken flat rice. And Krishna sees it. Just to enjoy the company of his old friend, Krishna began to smile and ask, "My dear friend, what have you brought for me? Has your wife given some nice eatables for me?" So Sudama was trying to hide that little cloth behind his back. And then Krishna says something that we heard before. I regard as great even the smallest gift offered by my devotees in pure love. But even great offerings presented by non-devotees do not please me. If one offers me with love and devotion, a leaf, a fruit, or a flower, or water, I will accept it. Sounds familiar, right? It's in the Bhagavatam, too. So, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur does this all the time. Somebody may doubt the Purvapaksha fellow and says, well, wait a minute. Yogakshema Vahamyaham. Krishna says, for one who is his devotee, he carries what he lacks and preserves what he has. So why is Sudama in this condition? And then comes the Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur answers that question that he raised. A distinction must be made between two kinds of renounced devotees. One kind is inimical to sense gratification. So inimical to sense gratification, disgusted with sense gratification. And no, is not this repulsion this the other side of attachment? So that was your question. The Supreme Lord does not force sense gratification upon the devotee who is extremely averse to worldly enjoyments. It's like, you know, Rishabhdev, when he went into this Avaduta phase. Or the personification of renunciation, Gorkishore Das Babaji, who would, just to have people leave him alone, he'd go in an outhouse in Navadvip, and bad smell. So people would stay away and leave him alone. Not because of being attached, but anyway. This is seen amongst great renouncers such as Jad Bharat. On the other hand, the Lord may give limitless wealth and power to a devotee who is neither repelled nor attracted by material things such as Prahlad. Up to this point of life, Sudama was totally averse to sense gratification. But now, out of compassion for his wife, and also because he hankered to have Krishna's audience, he went to beg from the Lord. So the Lord, for a couple of reasons, one already mentioned, it would be disturbing to Sudama in the presence of everyone there in Dwarka to receive opulence right there in Dwarka. So to refrain from Sudama's being embarrassed, he didn't say anything. But he was also respecting his position of not having a repulsion for sense gratification. So he didn't bring it up. We'll see. Continued. Krishna thought to himself, even the desire of Sudama's wife was motivated by loyalty to her husband. Thus, she is also without personal desire at all. Therefore, I will give them riches that even immortal demigods cannot obtain. The rationale is, above all, Krishna doesn't want his devotees to fall. So he knew that both Sudama and his wife wouldn't fall. If they had nothing, they wouldn't fall. If they had something, they wouldn't fall. If they had riches, they wouldn't fall. If they had riches surpassed the demigod, they wouldn't fall because of their spiritual qualification. So he was using his power of discretion whether to offer anything at all or not, as he may do with any one of us. But the opulences that Sudama received wasn't done in the presence of everybody. So Krishna snatched the little pouch of rice, opened the cloth, started eating, found it really yummy, and was reaching for another morsel, and Rukmini checked Krishna's hand. She normally doesn't say no to Krishna about anything, but she was a no to Krishna, saying, "This is more than enough, O soul of the universe, to secure an abundance of all kinds of wealth in this world and the next. After all, one's prosperity depends simply on your satisfaction." Now, some places it's said, not in our Acharya's commentary, but Rukmini was saying, "How are you going to repay him? He's taken some morsel. If you take more, how are you going to repay him?" Or, "It's low, inferior quality. It's not meant for you. We'll give you some nice rice later." But here's what she's saying in the Bhagavatam. She's the goddess of fortune, or the expansion of the goddess of fortune. She knows the purpose of Sudama's coming also without asking. And she knows what Krishna is going to do without asking. The learned Brahmana Sudama did not appear to have received anything substantial from Lord Krishna while at Krishna's palace. Yet he did not ask anything from the Lord, as he was too shy to beg for it on his own. So the whole half of the purpose of going there wasn't fulfilled because he was supposed to ask and he didn't ask. But he didn't have to ask. So next morning, Sudama starts his journey back to Porbandar. And he's thinking, of course, about having seen Krishna. Of course, they knew each other when they were boys. Now they're mature. And the beauty of Krishna, the kindness of Krishna, the worship of the Brahmana that Krishna extended to him. Then the fact that Krishna didn't ask him, and he was thinking, the verses say, "He didn't ask me because if he had asked me, I would have had to say, and if I, because I'm a Brahmin, I have to speak the truth, and if I said the truth, wealth, and one who gets some special mercy from Krishna like that, it's just nature. You get proud. And Krishna doesn't want his devotee to become proud. He wants his devotee not to fall from pride. So Krishna didn't even ask me why I came. Krishna's protecting me, meditating. Krishna's very kind." Jiva Goswami said, in his humility, he was thinking, "Krishna embraced me because I'm a Brahmana. And Krishna loves the Brahmana, so he embraced me, even though I'm not really a qualified Brahmana." So it wasn't at all a thought of his love for me as a devotee. It was just, he treated me just like one of his brothers, making me sit on the bed of his beloved consort. And he did this all with such respect and affection, as if I were his younger brother. And because I was fatigued, Rukmini also fanned me. She's the goddess of fortune. And she's fanning, treated with such kindness. So both of them, so kind, so merciful. Thinking in this way, the learned Brahmana gradually reached his own home. But he didn't find his home anymore. It was this humongous palace, made of valuable stones and jewels, glittering like the sun, moon, and rays of fire. Several palaces with beautifully decorated parks, with many beautiful men and women strolling. Nice lakes full of lotus flowers and beautiful lilies, flocks of multicolored birds. What happened? What happened? And he's still dressed in the same rags that he was wearing when he went to see Krishna. They saw him arrive because he was dressed like he the day before when he left. So they all came from the palaces and greeted him very cheerfully. Music, grand reception, auspicious songs. And then his wife came, and he didn't quite recognize, who are you? When he heard her voice, he could understand who it was. It's me, I'm your wife. Tears of joy fell from her eyes, and her voice became so choked up that she could not even address her husband. She simply closed her eyes in ecstasy. Now, it wasn't the ecstasy, now I were rich. The ecstasy was the kindness of Krishna having come into their lives. She just bowed before her husband. And within her mind, she thought of embracing him. Fully decorated, golden necklace, ornaments, maid servants, fine garments. Sudama was surprised. And he wondered, who is this demigod's wife who has approached such a fallen soul as me? The maidservant says, it's your wife. When the Brahmana entered his personal apartment in the palace along with his wife, he saw that it was not an apartment, but the residence of the King of Heaven. The palace was surrounded by many columns of jewels. He began to think, Krishna is so kind. I've always been very poor. Certainly, it's only possible for something like this to have happened because Krishna made it happen. And the greatest fortune was he just glanced upon me. And so this opulence isn't the good fortune, it's having received Krishna's glance. And then all of a sudden, his rags turned into also fine cloth and nice decorations. It was quite mystical. This is now Vishwanath, some nice points. He's paraphrasing all of this. Sudama is thinking, my beautiful dark friend Krishna is far more liberal than the cloud, which can fill the great ocean with water without disturbing the cultivator with rain during the day. The cloud brings liberal rain at night just to satisfy the agriculture man. And yet when the cultivator wakes up in the morning, he thinks, it hasn't rained enough. If Krishna bestowed this wealth upon me, Then why did he not tell me about it when we met in Dwarka? Certainly, my friend directly speaks and gives abundant wealth to beggars, like myself. I surmise that Krishna did not mention how he was going to fulfill my unspoken request, because at that time he was thinking, my dear friend has given me these grains of rice which are greater than all the treasures I own, even though in his own house he had no such gift to bring me. He took some trouble of begging it from a neighbor. Therefore, it is only proper that I give him something more valuable than all my possessions. But nothing is equal to or greater than what I possess. So, all I can give him is such meager things as the treasures of Indra, Brahma, and the demigods. Similarly, the Lord fulfills the desire of everyone according to his position. Yet, one who is not in Krishna consciousness, of course this is a devotee's rendering of in Krishna consciousness, considers all the gifts of the Lord to be less than his desire, like the cultivator. On the other hand, when the Lord receives a little thing in love and affection from his devotee, he considers it a great and valuable gift. The vivid example is me. I simply offered him a morsel of chipped rice, and in exchange he has given me opulence greater than the opulence of the King of Heaven. So in his mind, he's amazed at the ways of Krishna's reciprocation with his visit. And within his mind, he's offering this prayer to Krishna for these two things, to always be in this relationship of service to him, and to always be in the association of those who are dear to Krishna, his devotees. But he's just naturally a very humble soul, feeling unworthy of Krishna's gift, wondering, you know, if Krishna was really kind, why did he just leave me in the condition I was in? Because now there's some risk. I can become attached. I can become proud. So if Krishna was really kind, he wouldn't have given me these things. But he's testing me. So let me remain steadfast in my determination to not become an enjoyer of these things. And so he continued in the same practices that he had before. He slept on the earth and kept himself in a simple manner and dedicated his time and energy to increasing his worship of Krishna and his hearing of topics of scripture, Krishna, and reading of the scriptures. So his position didn't become deviated. His position became strengthened as the result of the opulence that he had gained. Vishwanath says, whatever darkness of material contamination remained within his heart was completely now cleared away. And shortly thereafter, he was transferred to the spiritual world. And the end of that chapter, 81, Shukadev Goswami says, all persons who hear this history of Sudama and Lord Krishna will know how affectionate Lord Krishna is to the Brahmana devotees, like Sudama. Anyone who hears this history gradually becomes as qualified as Sudama, and thus he also is transferred to the spiritual kingdom of Lord Krishna. In Krishna's Leela, there's a counterpart for each of the personalities in Lord Chaitanya's Leela, and Gauradesh Deepika indicates that Suklambar Brahmachari is the same as Sudama in Krishna's pastimes. There's one reference in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Navadvipa Dham Mahatmya that Kolavachar Shridhar and Sudama are the same. But in Chaitanya Bhagavat, there's a lengthy description. Suklambar Brahmachari lived by begging door to door, and whatever he received, he put in the same, like a cloth pouch tied in the corners. And people that didn't understand his spiritual stature would make fun of him and criticize him and look down upon him. And he didn't mind because he was just fixed in Krishna consciousness. And one time, Chaitanya Bhagavat described that Suklambar Brahmachari happened to come in the presence of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu at the house of Shivas. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that particular evening was in the mood of the Supreme Lord. And there was a wonderful kirtan going on. And Suklambar, hearing the kirtan, seeing the Lord, started dancing and dancing in ecstasy, holding this little bag behind him. And Mahaprabhu got down from his seat and snatched the bag and started eating from the bag, the little whatever items that he had in his begging bag. And Suklambar was holding his head, saying, "I'll go to hell for this. This is unfit for you." And similar expression, Mahaprabhu saying, "This is the greatest happiness of my life, receiving whatever offerings I receive from you," and embraced him and bestowed upon him Krishna Prema. So that's the conclusion of the section we didn't get to finish earlier. And then the final section is Krishna's visit to Vrindavan. Now, I was surprised to find out from when we visited in Dwarka that there were a lot of people that came up afterwards and said, "Well, wait a minute, I thought Krishna never went back to Vrindavan, but Krishna went back to Vrindavan." And we're going to hear some of that detail, but before Krishna goes back to Vrindavan, the Jai and Vijay were in the final of the three lifetimes as demons. They were not Kamsa, but Shishupal and the other one, Dantavakra. So after there's a sequence of events which Sanatan Goswami summarizes, but this Rajasuya Yajna was preceded by Krishna killing Jarasandha, because there was this event in Dwarka where one messenger came and another messenger came. Narada Muni came saying, "Krishna, you're being requested to come and join the Rajasuya Yajna for Yudhisthira Maharaj." And another came saying, "Jarasandha is causing so much trouble, you gotta do something." So Krishna turned to Uddhava and asked Uddhava for Uddhava's advice. And Uddhava's advice was, before the Rajasuya is done, all opposing kings should be right. So first Jarasandha, then second the Rajasuya. So Jarasandha was by a plan that Krishna gave, he was destroyed. And then the Rajasuya was performed. And during the Rajasuya, there's a procedure at a certain point after certain purificatory mantras and invoking auspicious, the principal person in the assembly is honored, just part of the yajna. And this is where the chapter begins. It's chapter 74, so this precedes what we just heard about Sudama, so many other things, 74, 75, Balaram's tour in 79, and then the Sudama story is 80, 81. So I'm going back to 74. The qualified brahmanas were selected, the great assembly of Brahmanas, Bhardraj Muni, Gautama Muni, Vashishta, and others were the chief priests of the Yajna, and everything was prepared. All the exalted spiritual masters of the three worlds, like, there's a long list of persons, have come to assemble here. And the rulers of various planets have come to assemble here. And they're, all of us are eager to carry upon our heads the command of Krishna. And that receiving the command of Krishna is very, very special. It makes our meaning of our lives full, gives us strength and energy and enthusiasm. So, in a very humble way, Yudhisthira is in this wonderful assembly indicating Krishna. Oh, unconquerable Madhava, even your devotees make no distinction of I and mine, you and yours, for this is the perverted mentality of animals. Such distinctions are visible in the lives of everyone, even the animals, but pure devotees are freed from these false distinctions. Since these distinctions are absent in your devotees, they cannot possibly be present in you. So, the auspicious time for the yajna had come, the initial mantras were recited, all the personalities were properly honored, and then it became time for honoring the most important person in the assembly. So Sahadev, especially amongst all those in the assembly, he stood up, took the honor of speaking, that Krishna should be honored, and he gives his reasons. I'll give the reasons, they're nice. I'm just looking at the clock. Because this, what comes at the end is much, it's very important. It's even nicer than this part. But person is Achyuta, the Supreme Personality of God, a chief of the Yadus, who deserves the highest position. In truth, he himself comprises all the demigods worshipped in sacrifice, along with such aspects of the worship of the sacred place, the time, and the paraphernalia. The entire universe is founded upon him, as are all the great sacrificial performances, etc., etc., etc. He creates the many activities of this world. Thus, by his grace, the whole world endeavors for the ideals of Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha. It is, in fact, superfluous to speak more about Krishna. Every one of you exalted personalities knows Krishna, the Supreme Brahman, for whom there are no material differences between body, part of the body and another. So he finished more and more. His, everyone saying, right on, brother. Excellent. Yes. So, the worship of Krishna begins in Maharaj Yudhisthira. Yudhisthira is treated by Krishna in a number of ways as a subordinate to a superior. Like when the wedding, Draupadi's wedding took place, Krishna took the position of being the one of the bards that would go before the procession and sing the glories of Maharaj Yudhisthira. And during the Rajasuya, Krishna took the position of washing everybody's feet when they came for the guests. Now he is being worshipped by Yudhisthira. He's getting back at him. After bathing Krishna's feet, Maharaj Yudhisthira joyfully sprinkled the water upon his own head, and then upon the heads of his wife, brothers and family members. As he honored the Lord with presentations of yellow silken garments and precious eyes, prevented him from looking directly at the Lord. When the members present in the assembly saw Lord Krishna thus honored, nearly all who were present joined their palms reverentially, exclaiming, "Obeisances unto you, all victory to you." And then they also bowed before Krishna. Flowers came sprinkling from the sky. There was one person who was really disturbed, Shishupal. He couldn't take it anymore, hearing all this glorification of Krishna. So he just bolted up and stood up from his seat, and waving his arms angrily with in a challenging, rough tone, started speaking very harsh things. Vishwanath said he waited, because if he had done this before the worship of Krishna had begun, then the whole performance would have been called off. And upon hearing my points, the assembly will stop worshipping Krishna and worship a qualified person instead, then the sacrifice will proceed properly. So he decided, "I'm going to be silent in the beginning, but after Krishna's worship, I will make sure everybody clearly understands and accepts my position. He shouldn't be worshipped in this way, and how the sacrifice has been spoiled." Then, with all my associates, I'll depart. All my allies, my kings, my friends, my cohorts, and Duryodhana and buddies. So, if you want to hear some offense against Krishna, I can read to you what Shishupal said. But he said many bad things. Many bad things. And as he was saying the many bad things, naturally, the entire assembly, the mood was a reverse mood. And the reverse mood was not, "Yeah, he's right." The reverse mood was, "Shishupal, dump him." And so they started reaching for their swords. Bhima grabbing his club, raising his club. Krishna raised his hand, told them to stop just by the motion of his hand. And as he kept going and going and going, there was some promise that he had made that he wouldn't take the life of Shishupal, because it was known Shishupal was inimical toward Krishna from literally the day of his birth. So a promise was given that 100 times he'll make offense before he'll bring any harm to him. So after the 100th time, it just got so much out of control. Krishna just made a choice. He said, "If I don't do something, they'll do something. And if they do something, the whole sacrificial arena is going to get all bloody. So I'll just do this in such a way it won't get all bloody." That's what the commentary says. There's Jiva Goswami gives some nice commentary on what to do. It's similar to what's in Nectar of Devotion. What to do when you hear blasphemy. You may not be the one that's giving it, but if you hear it, what are your options? Same as Nectar of Devotion. If one hears an irresponsible person blaspheme the master and controller of religion, one should block his ears and go away if unable to punish him. But if one is able to kill, then one should, by force, cut out the blasphemer's tongue and kill the offender. And after that, one should give up his own life. Of course, you're not supposed to take the life of a Vaishnava, so you leave the place or defeat the person. And there's a lot of Bhakti Siddhanta saying, not only the person speaking, but the person hearing such speaking, they're also offenders. So there's instructions in the Bhagavatam. Anyone who fails to immediately leave the place where he hears criticism of the Supreme Lord or his faithful devotee will certainly fall down, bereft of his pious credit. So, Krishna drew his Sudarshan Chakra, neutralizing the situation. Impossible, it's gone too far. If I don't do something, they'll do something, and then the yagya will be destroyed. So Krishna decided. He drew his Sudarshan Chakra and severed his head in such a way that not a drop of blood fell within the sacrificial arena. There wasn't blood, but not in the sacrificial arena spot. And when Shishupal was killed, there was a big roar in the assembly. Taking advantage of that disturbance, the few kings who were supporters of Shishupal quickly left the assembly out of fear of their own lives. An effulgent light rose from Shishupal's body. Same thing happens again with Dantravakra, by the way. And as everyone watched, entered into Lord Krishna just like a meteor falling from the sky to the earth. In the commentary, Vishwanath says, Shishupal remained within Krishna until the end of Lord Krishna's earthly pastimes at Prabhas, and then returned to the side of his master, the Supreme Lord of Vaikuntha, in case you wanted to know. The popular view, however, is that Shishupal achieved impersonal liberation by merging in Krishna's bodily effulgence, Sayuja Mukti. That's Vishwanath saying all that. Prabhas is a very special place. Jiva Goswami comments, from his body of light, which could not be seen by the eyes or other senses, very small in size, entered Krishna. When Shishupal died, it is said, whatever bhuvi kachchuta, it was like a meteor falling from the sky to the earth. Since it could not be seen by the eye, it was extraordinary. But all people saw it directly. By the Lord's will, they could see it. In astonishment, Shukadev called to Parikshit. An associate of the Lord, as associates of the Lord, both were similar. This means that Dantavakra also entered the spiritual world as the Lord's devotee again. Vishwanath asks the tough question, how is this possible? He's an offender. How did he enter into the body of the Supreme Pure Lord Vasudeva? And the answer is by absorbing his thoughts. Even in enmity, for three births, Shishupal attained that auspicious outcome. And he gained his position in Vaikuntha. So, after the yagya is finished, Yudhisthira distributed charity to everybody as is proper. And then the conclusion, the person who was the beneficiary of the yagya, he took a very special sacred bath, and the program was over. And Krishna remained in Hastinapur for a few months, and because he had some pastimes to perform. Then with permission from the king, Krishna then returned to Dwarka. Now, when Krishna returns to Dwarka, before he gets back to returning to Dwarka, there's a problem. And that is, because he stayed for a few months, persons that were friendly towards Shishupal went to Dwarka to attack the Yadu dynasty in Dwarka. They kind of left Krishna alone in Hastinapur and went to attack Dwarka. So, as Krishna was returning to Dwarka, he found that there's this big battle going on. And so, Balaram wasn't there for the Rajasuya. Balaram was left behind. And so Pradyumna was there. Pradyumna said, let me take care of this. Pradyumna went out onto the battlefield. And one of the soldiers that was present was Duman. And so Pradyumna and Duman had this confrontation. And with four arrows, his four horses were struck. Two more arrows, his bow and his chariot flag were cut, and one arrow was finished Duman's head. So the fighting went on. There's the rest of the soldiers of Shalva attacking one another back and forth. So Krishna now is heading back, understanding that the capital city of Dwarka is under attack. And when Krishna arrived, there was Shalva. Now, Shalva had been present at the time of Rukmini's marriage. He was on the Shishupal friend's side. And when Shishupal was deprived of the marriage to Rukmini, Shalva went on the warpath. He underwent very severe austerities. He wasn't ground powder or ground iron filings. It was something, just dust, for a long time. Forget the duration of time. Lord Shiva requested, what's your benediction? What's your favorite benediction? So he wanted a mystical craft that could harass the Yadu dynasty, so Mayadhanava made one for him. And it was called Sobha. So Krishna had Daruka's driver approach Shalva. And Krishna warned Daruka, Shalva has some mystic powers and don't trust him. He'll show some things. Don't worry about it. So they went out to the battlefield. Shalva saw the flag of Garuda on Krishna's chariot and immediately started approaching Krishna, threw a spear at Krishna, crossed the battlefield. Krishna smashed it. And so he got other weapons and so on and so on and so on. The significant in this encounter between Shalva and Krishna, Krishna shot with his Sarnga bow, the same bow we heard about before, some arrows that splintered all of his weapons. Then Shalva fired some weapon that knocked the Sarnga bow from Krishna's left hand. And the demigods trembled. Oh no. So there's this long discussion about how did that happen, and it's just, you know, it's in short, because of time. It's a pastime, and Krishna wanted to display human-like characteristics, you know, human-like as humans make mistakes or they're fallible. So he who is Achyuta appeared to be Chuta, or Ajita became Jita. Then Shalva pulled another mystic trick. An apparition looking like his father was brought by a third person before Krishna, saying, "This is your father, and we're going to kill him," and severed the head of the apparition. So the head of the apparition, Vasudeva, fell to the ground. And then Krishna felt feelings that looked like Ram feeling bereavement at the loss of Sita, as if he's a worldly person. So Krishna, for a moment, felt those feelings. Apparently, felt those feelings. He soon recalled, however, that this was the demoniac illusion engineered by Maya Dhanava and employed by Shalva. Now, alert to the actual situation, Lord Achyuta saw before him on the battlefield neither the messenger nor his father's body. It was as if he had awakened from a dream. Seeing his enemy flying above him in the Saubha plain, Krishna prepared to kill him. Such is the account given by some sages, O wise king, but those who speak of this illogical way are contradicting themselves, having forgotten their own previous statements. So there's like seven verses in a row describing the bow falling from his hand and Vasudeva apparition apparently causing Krishna to become bewildered. So you can imagine there's this long commentary, and the essence of the long commentary is two main things. Because of time, I'm not going to do all this. The detail is nice. But the essence is, there are other circumstances where Krishna enjoys so many things, unlimited things, and one of his enjoyments is these appearances of becoming bewildered. Like when the cowherd boys entered the mouth of the Agasura demon, Krishna became covered by his own yogamaya potency for his own happiness. Or when he saw the cowherd boys before the Kaliya lake, they looked as if they were dead. Krishna was bewildered. Then his yogamaya potency was withdrawn, and he knew exactly what to do, brought them back to life and everything. So it's Krishna's pastime, enjoying different humors of pleasure. And then another instruction that comes from our acharyas is, these wrong understandings are sometimes found in the Puranas. And the Puranas are compiled by Vyas. So what do we do when we find these other examples? Just like it's mentioned specifically, Vishwanath mentions that in Skanda Purana, There's many places where it's very clear Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And there's some other obscure remarks that he has a material body, like us, which isn't the position of the Personality of Godhead. So how do we handle those verses? And we discussed this in Dwaraka in a different context, but the Tattva Sandarbha seminar. Secondary meanings have to be derived if the primary meaning doesn't make sense. Some of you that attended that seminar, you remember. Just like, it's a Sanskrit rule, just like in the chapter 18 of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna addresses Arjuna as tiger amongst men. So there's a direct meaning that he's a man that has fangs and claws, and he, you know, eats people or eats animals and just devours them and rips them to pieces, and that's Arjuna. That's a direct meaning, so it's not a correct meaning. So you have to take a secondary meaning. Otherwise, you must take the primary meaning. And so Similarly, the commentators say, this final authority amongst all the Puranas, which all the Puranas, including Skanda Purana, accepts, is the Bhagavatam. So if there's something in any one of the Puranas, Skanda or any other ones, that say something contradictory to the Srimad Bhagavatam, then you have to take an indirect or a secondary meaning. It can't be like that. It can't be that Krishna was feeling worldly feelings. It can't be. It can't be. I mean, there's logic and there's statements. The logic says, by meditating upon Krishna and hearing topics about Krishna, one goes beyond the modes of nature, one's karma is destroyed, and so forth. So it can't be that Krishna is within the field of the material energy, that he, like us, feels bewildered, or he, like us, can be conquered. He's Ajita. He can't be conquered. So it's not possible. Not possible. So therefore we have to reconcile those statements against the primary statements of the Bhagavatam and so forth. So it's like these are the two messages. He's enjoying. And his enjoying is not like us, what happened to us when we feel some pause or some moment where we don't know should we turn left or right or what's going on or our confusion. His confusion is not like ours. Our confusion is not like his. His confusion, his apparent confusion, is a mood of ecstasy, a type of happiness that according to his desire, he enters and in the next moment he's not in it anymore. That is how to understand those. And so Shukadeva Goswami is declaring it specifically. A lot of explanation. How can lamentation, bewilderment, material affection, or fear, all born out of ignorance, be ascribed to the infinite Supreme Lord, whose perception, knowledge, and power are all similarly infinite? Not possible. So some indirect understanding or secondary meaning must be taken. And similarly, how did his bow fall? Sanatan Goswami takes that one on. Lamentation and other emotions are of two types. One, caused by ignorance. Another, caused by knowledge. The emotions described here are possible in people who are ignorant, or who do not know everything, or who are dependent on wrong sources of knowledge. But how is it possible for the Supreme Lord, who has unlimited knowledge? Transcendental lamentation and other such spiritual emotions are possible in those who have perfect awareness of the world beyond illusion. This applies to the devotees and the Lord himself, who is the original source of all nectarian rasas arising as sanchari bhav, which are part of rasa. And he gives as an example Krishna's being afraid of the stick in Mother Jasoda's hand. How is that possible? He's fear by fear personified, but it's an emotion that he likes, and he experiences that emotion with his loving devotee, Mother Jasoda. Similarly, Krishna is running from Kaliyavanas, not out of fear. Oh, Kaliyavana is too powerful, I have to run. Something else. He wanted to honor Muchukunda, so he drew him to Muchukunda's cave and let Muchukunda do the honor. Vishnu says it's the impossibility of Krishna's being fooled by Shalva's tricks is further explained here in the Bhagavatam, which states that Krishna's devotees can never be bewildered, so what to speak of Krishna? Next, when Shalva thought that Krishna had been bewildered by it, fired up, as we say in ISKCON, and began to attack Krishna with greater vigor, showering volumes of arrows. But the enthusiasm of Shalva can be compared with the speedy march of flies into a fire. Krishna, with infathomable strength, hurled arrows at Shalva, injuring Shalva, piercing his armor, which scattered into pieces. Krishna smashed him with his club. Shalva's airplane burst into pieces and fell in the sea. That mystical thing made by Maya Dhanava is now gone. So Shalva picked up his club and rushing at Krishna to smash Krishna. Krishna's arm that was holding his club. So Krishna lifted his Sudarshan chakra and decided that's enough of this and just employing his disc, Hari removed the great magician's head with its earrings and crown, just as Purandara, Lord Indra, had used his thunderbolt to cut off Vritra's head. Alas! Shalva's gone, the Sobha, airship is gone, Dantavakra's next. Dantavakra was a relative of Krishna. Dantavakra was Vasudeva's brother, and Kunti's brother. So he's uncle. Is that right? That is what I recall. Let's see. After the demise of Shishupal, Shalva and Pondraka, that happened earlier, a foolish demoniac king named Dantavakra wanted to kill Krishna to avenge the death of his friend Shalva. He became so agitated that he appeared in the battlefield without the proper arms and ammunition, without even a chariot. The only weapon he had was his anger. He carried only a club in his hand, but he was so powerful that when he moved, everyone felt the earth tremble. Let's see. Yeah. Dantavakra was the maternal cousin of Krishna. So Dantavakra's mother, Shruta Shrava, was Vasudeva's sister. So they're cousins. You are maternal cousin, Krishna, but you committed violence against my friends. And now you want to kill me also, therefore, fool. I will kill you with my thunderbolt club. Then, O unintelligent one, I am obliged to my friends. Will have repaid my debt to them by killing you. My enemy disguised as a relative, who are like a disease within my body. You know, chivalrous words. Dantavakra struck Krishna on the head. Krishna didn't budge. Took his massive Kamadaki club and struck Dantavakra one time in the middle of his chest, his heart shattered, vomit of blood came out of his mouth, and a most subtle and wondrous spark of light rose from the demon's body and entered Lord Krishna, while everyone looked on, just as when Shishupal was killed. But it's not over yet, because Dantavakra, Krishna's cousin, had a brother, Vidurata. And he's got to take revenge for the death of his brother, who took revenge because of the death of Shishupal, who took revenge because of he's crazy. O best of kings, as Vidurata fell upon him, Lord Krishna used his razor-edged Sudarshan disc to remove his head, complete with its helmet and earrings, having thus destroyed Shalva and his Sobha airship, along with Dantavakra and his younger brother, all of whom were invincible before any other opponent. Lord Krishna was praised by the demigods. Human beings and great sages, Siddhas, Gandharvas, Vidyadharas, Apsaras, and so forth. They sang his glory, showered flowers. Lord Krishna entered back into the capital city. Then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, listen carefully, this is how Krishna goes back to Vrindavan. So in the several references, and it starts with Padma Purana reference, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur refers that after Shishubal had been killed, Dantavakra went to Mathura to fight Krishna. So Krishna heard of this, so Krishna mounted his chariot and went to Mathura, and at the gates of Mathura, that's where their battle took place. At the gates of Mathura that lasted all day and night. And finally, after Krishna killed Dantavakra, then Vidurata, then Krishna was so close to Vrindavan, and he had made a promise that and Krishna keeps his promise. So Krishna, from Mathura, entered Vrindavan. So Vishwanath writes, in this passage of the Padma Purana, the words, when Krishna heard of this, indicate that the Lord heard from Narada, who travels as swiftly as the mind, that Dantavakra had gone to Mathura. So to protect the residents of Mathura, Krishna went after killing Shalva. So there's Shishupal in Hastinapur. He went back to Dwaraka to kill Shalva, and from Dwaraka he went all the way to Mathura. And a really swift chariot, in a single moment he reached Mathura. There he saw Dantavakra. Thus it is that even today, by the gate of Mathura, facing the direction of Dwaraka, there's a village known in the vernacular as Datiha. Datiha, taken as a corruption of Dantavakra, ha, becomes Datiha, the killer of Dantavakra. A village that was founded by Krishna's great-grandson Vajra. Currently, the village is known as Datiya. Vishwanath continues. In the same section of Padma Purana, these statements are found. After the killing of Vidurata, Krishna crossed the Jamuna and went to the cowherd village of Nanda. Now, it's said, whenever he entered Vraja, he took on his Vraja attire. And when he leaves Vraja, he puts on his Mathura or Dwaraka attire. He dresses appropriately for the occasion. Like when he met the washerman entering Mathura. Got to dress for the occasion. So this is Padma Purana. He came before Nanda Maharaj. Krishna honored and consoled his aggrieved parents. They drenched him with tears and embraced him. And then the Lord offered obeisances to the elder cowherd men and gratified all the residents with abundant gifts of clothing, ornaments, and so on. Lord Keshava sported continuously with the cowherd women on the Kalindi's charming bank, which was filled with pious trees. Thus the Supreme Lord, assuming the appearance of a cowherd, resided there for 2 months. This is all quoting Padma Purana. Enjoying the pleasure of intimate pastimes and various moods of loving reciprocation. And there's details of those 2 months presented in Padma Purana. Then, what happens next? According to Padma Purana, Krishna sent the demigods back to their abodes and sent, as he did with the concluding of his pastimes in Dwarka, and the eternal associates of Krishna, he sent back to their eternal abode, and then in their uppercut form, their expansions remained, and Krishna remained in his uppercut lila with them, and then his prakat lila, he returned back to Dwarka. Pretty complicated, but that's what happened. By Lord Vasudeva's grace, Nanda and all the other residents of that place, together with their children and wives, assumed their eternal spiritual forms, boarded a celestial airplane, and ascended to the supreme Vaikuntha planet Goloka Vrindavan. Lord Krishna, however, after bestowing on Nanda Gopa and all the other inhabitants of Vraja his own transcendental abode, which is free from all disease, traveled through the sky and returned to Dwarka as demigods chanted his praises. Padma Purana. Pretty mystical. Vishwanath continues, furthermore, Shukadev considered that Maharaj Parikshit might think, so why isn't all of this in the Bhagavatam and we find it over in Padma Purana? Because Shukadev, rather than read it, I'll say it. Shukadev was concerned. When Maharaj Parikshit hears of how his family members in Dwarka, the Yadu dynasty folks, how they killed each other off and tens of thousands of them, bloody death and so forth, that's what happened to them and the residents of Vrindavan. They went back in a Vaikuntha airplane. He might get emotional about that. So he didn't speak about it in detail. But rather there's mention of it in Canto 1, and we'll see that in just a moment. Chapter 11, text 9. This is Krishna's returning to Dwarka. 10 is he leaves Hastinapur. 11, he returns to Dwarka. O lotus-eyed Lord, residents of Dwarka are speaking to Krishna or praying to Krishna. Whenever you go away to Mathura, Vrindavan, or Hastinapur to meet your friends and relatives, every moment of your absence to us seems like a million years. Lord Krishna had been harboring, that's the end of the quote, Lord Krishna had been harboring a desire to go see his friends and relatives in Vraja ever since Lord Baladev had gone there, but even before that, but when Uddhava went there. But his mother, father, and other elders in Dwarka had refused to give him permission. Now, however, after killing of Shalva, when Krishna heard from Narada that Dantavakra had gone to Mathura, no one could object to the Lord's going there immediately without first entering Dwarka, because the battle was outside of Dwarka. After killing Dantavakra, he would have the opportunity to meet with his friends and relatives living in Vraja. Thinking like this, and also remembering Uddhava's description from earlier chapter of the Bhagavatam, where his going to Vraja left the, him with the impression of the difficulty of the residents of Vrindavan, Krishna wanted to go. Thus, at the end of 2 months, he withdrew his Vraja pastimes from mundane eyes by taking the demigod portion of his parents, the demigod portion of his parents. So there's this interesting description that within the spiritual form of Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj, there were demigod personalities that their partial expansions entered into the body of Yashoda and Nanda. So he sent them back to their demigod place. Forget their names. Dara and something. Drona and Dara? Something like that. Drona and Dara. And other relatives and friends to Vaikuntha. Thus, in one complete plenary manifestation, he went to Goloka in the spiritual world. In another, he remained perpetually enjoying in Vraja while invisible to material eyes. And yet, another, he mounted his chariot and returned back to Dwaraka. No problem. What's the problem? He's unlimitedly potent and he can expand himself and do these things without difficulty. The people of Shurasena province thought that after killing Dantavakra, Krishna had paid a visit to his parents and other dear ones and now is returning to Dwaraka. The people of Vraja, on the other hand, could not understand where he had suddenly disappeared to. And so they were totally astonished, as are we. Sanatan Goswami, in his commentary on this section, gives the following sequence. I'll say it twice because it's the sequence is important. So the Kurukshetra sojourn towards the end of the 10th canto Bhagavatam came chronologically first. The residents of Vrindavan and the residents of Dwaraka meet at Kurukshetra. Then the Rajasuya. Then the gambling match. Then the attempt to disrobe Draupadi. Then the exile into the forest. Then the killing of Shalva. Then Dantavakra. Then Krishna's visiting Vrindavan. And finally, the winding up of the Vrindavan pastimes. So I'll do it again. From Sanatan Goswami's commentary, 10th canto commentary, the solar eclipse, the Rajasuya Yajna, the gambling match, Draupadi attempted to be disrobed, exile in the forest, Shalva was killed, Dantavakra was killed, Krishna enters Vrindavan, and then the winding up of the Vrindavan pastimes. Thus, Jai and Vijay, on the pretext of the curse of the four Kumaras, appeared on earth three times to facilitate the pastimes of the Lord. In three consecutive lifetimes, they were killed by the Lord himself, and then they attained liberation. So the last reference, I won't go through the detail of, but in his Laghu Bhagavatamrita, Rupa Goswami covers the same subject matter, and he does it very systematically, very logically, one after the next. And, you know, somebody might say, well, here's another possible explanation. He rules that out. And should I read it? It's already 5:30, time to end. So what I'll do is, for those that registered, just this Laghu Bhagavatamrita section, I'll circulate it. I'll give it to whoever did the registration, and you can get a copy, and you can know what Rupa Goswami says from Laghu Bhagavatamrita. Or by Laghu Bhagavatamrita. Read it. Any discussion? Krishna returned to Vrindavan. And Brihat Bhagavatamrita, yes, microphone. In Brihat Bhagavatamrita, it says that Krishna regularly returned. And the residents of Vrindavan, by their ecstatic love for Krishna and the mercy of the Yogamaya potency, they would forget. As soon as they saw Krishna, they forgot that he had gone anywhere. And it was like he had never left. And then Akura comes again and takes Krishna away, and there's this awful scene, and they're feeling separation, and Krishna's gone for a while, and Krishna comes back again, and forget. It's a rerun, according to Brihat Bhagavatamrita. Yes?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Maharaj, you was mentioning the one who criticizes Lord or his devotees, we should stay away from such person. Something like that?
One is also an offender, whether speaking or hearing. That's the message.
Yeah.
So there's a proper behavior that we're to observe if we hear.
So my question is, it happens so that when a disciple of a certain guru, he criticizes, he talks to the disciple of another guru. So, but that disciple explains to the former disciple who was criticizing that it could be your perception about the guru you are criticizing. And then the first disciple, he says to the second disciple, okay, it may be my perception, and he doesn't talk about it. So in that situation, is it okay to keep association of such devotee if he doesn't talks about the same point in future?
Well, two things. One is, it's not just your Diksha Guru, it's someone who's in the position. Someone who's an exalted sadhu, whether they're Diksha Guru, Shiksha Guru, or somebody else's Diksha Guru, or somebody else's, hearing about any one of those categories is in the same, you know, concern, spiritual offense concern. That's the first point. And if one doesn't continue to, I mean, the instruction is never to see that person's face again, but it's you leave the place. That's the instruction. And based upon that instruction, what you just said is, if the person said, well, it's my perception, then it's not that you can't have anything to do with that person ever again. But, you know, I would recommend, please don't share your perceptions. If you have a concern about person X, go to person X. Whoever they may be. A manager, or a sadhu, or a, you know, Vaishnava. Vishnudas. Go to Vishnudas, or guru so-and-so, or manager so-and-so. Go to them and express what your concern is. And if you can't do that, don't do these things. Don't go to person C and speak about person B. Just don't do that. Whether they heed that advice or not, you're giving good advice. And if you feel you can't do that for whatever the reason, then, you know, keep it to yourself. Or take it to someone not in a mood of criticism, but in a mood of, I'm dutifully reporting what is my perception. I don't know if I'm right or wrong. Take it to the right source. Not, you know, breach of etiquette leads to deterioration of the social fabric. In general, you know, one such behavior leads to exponentially more. So my advice is, don't be a participant in it. Walk away from it, or, you know, say, in the case like you just said, I accept that it's your perception. Please don't share your perception with me or with others. It's not going to be helpful to the situation, for you or for the situation, or for our Vaishnava community. If you have a concern, take it to the right source. Take it to that person directly, or to one who is in the position to address the concern. But don't go spreading this around. My perception. Please. Now, they're going to do whatever they're going to do, but from your side, you've spoken correctly.
So I was in
they'll probably say, you're no fun, I'm not going to bring stuff to you anymore. So they won't bring stuff to you anymore because you're no fun. You don't get into it with them. Oh, really? That's your perception, huh? You got any more perceptions? You're no fun. You don't want to hear that stuff.
I was in a certain situation, so I said that I don't want to hear it again. So he said, of course, I will not share, and he will not tell me again. And he didn't tell me again also.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, so, but because we cannot avoid general association. Is it okay to keep association if he's not repeating it again?
It's natural. You associate with sources of elevation. It's natural. You don't have to feel, ill or animosity or negativity. Just, keep in toxic areas, you keep a little distance. Unless you see there's a change of demeanor, and then you can consider. Otherwise, keep a safe distance. Respectful distance. And hopefully, there's village elders, that's my term, seniors in the community that understand there's such and such propensity floating around, and it needs to be addressed for the wholesomeness of the community. And then it's in their hands. And it's not easy to address because some people are, have a certain nature. There's this expression, the dog's curved tail. You can straighten it out, but let go and it's going to curve again. Oh, I won't do it again.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Yes.
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. The question I had was, I don't know if my understanding is right, that Vrindavan pastimes are eternal.
Vrindavan pastimes are eternal, and it requires eternal associates of Krishna to engage in those pastimes. So sometimes those pastimes are manifest and sometimes they're not.
But when we read that Krishna ended the pastimes of Vrindavan...
That's the manifest pastimes.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
Aprakat pastimes are eternal.
Okay.
But the manifest pastimes came to a close.
Yes. Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay, in front of you.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. The question is, as you said, to Parikshit Maharaj, Sukhdev Goswami didn't reveal that Krishna returned to Vrindavan because of the sensitivity. So the question is, as Parikshit Maharaj was hearing for 7 days, and though he was concerned about his ancestors, but he also heard about many, many personalities. So I didn't understand what was the exact sensitivity because of which...
It's a social sensitivity. You don't want to hurt somebody's feelings. There's other examples. I'll give two other examples. When Vidura came back to Hastinapura and he was received by Yudhisthira and the Pandavas and Kunti and Dhritarashtra, he didn't say what he knew. Krishna's gone. The whole Yadu dynasty is gone. He didn't say. He didn't want to bear bad news. Because the bearer of bad news, feelings go to the bearer of bad news, not just the bad news. He didn't want to disturb their feelings. So he was very sensitive about that. Anyway, there's other examples. So, Shukadev Goswami, that just deleted a certain portion of Krishna's pastimes because Maharaj Parikshit might have felt, well, wait a minute. My relatives, this happened, and the Vrindavan residents, that happened. That's not fair. Krishna's partial, or something, whatever feelings might have come. So he didn't say. He indicated in chapter, whenever Krishna, forget the Sanskrit term, but whenever means that it would happen more than one time, would go to Mathura and Vrindavan to see his associates there. So it happened. He indicates it happened. He just doesn't give the detail of what happened when it happened. But that's the reason why.
Related to the first question, Guru Maharaj, about blasphemy, what can be done if one unintentionally or by mistake reads something blasphemous over the internet?
Be very careful next time you go to the internet. It's a Kali, and there's impetuses for quarrel all around us. So how are you going to avoid the potential of incidences of quarrel in the age of Kali? Just be careful. There's not much you can do. You know, go to Krishna and say, accidentally this happened. I'm going to carefully guard against it. Like that.
Hare Krishna, yeah. Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
This question is regarding chanting. How effective is chanting while driving, doing your japa while driving? This question is not for me.
Well,
but
we, you know, kirtaniya sadahari, right? So part of our life is we're driving, so you can chant while you're driving. It's part of sada, but it's not part of your 16 rounds.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay?
Okay. Thank you, Maharaj.
You can chant while you're cooking. Okay. One last question, and then I think we're finished for the day.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. Thank you very much. Maharaj, this question is with a reference to the Sudama pastime.
Sudama.
Yeah. So, while practicing the Krishna consciousness, a devotee may become like a more humbler or submissive or kind of... is there any possibility that he may also may develop pride or attached?
Of course.
So.
Oh, I'm so humble. That was explicitly spoken of by Vishwanath about Sudama. Sudama doesn't say he was, but may have been in traces feeling, oh, I'm such a detached brahmana. So Krishna took that away. He gave him opulence. But he maintained his detachment, but, you know, the trace, Vishwanath says, the trace of pride in being a detached brahmana was taken away. So one can be proud of how humble I am, or something like that, which is obviously a contradiction. Proud of how humble I am.
So, Maharaj,
so it's easy. It's like falling off a log. It's like we do it all the time.
So Maharaj, so what exactly the definition of being humble in the Krishna consciousness?
What exactly, as opposed to the lie that I've been telling you of what humble means?
I mean,
I don't like that kind of a question. What does it really mean? Instead of all this other stuff you're talking about. So, it's very simple. You're part of Krishna. Here it is. Krishna is very great. I'm very tiny. Therefore, I should serve him. That's all. That is Krishna. Prabhupada said, that is Krishna consciousness. Now, how great is Krishna? And how tiny I am? We can refine that understanding, but the essence of it is that. Our humility increases as we understand the nature of Krishna. How far we are from being Krishna's competitor. I'm not Krishna's competitor, no competition. Therefore, my position is I'm his servant. Let me serve him. That's the position. Okay, Srila Prabhupada
Ki Jai.